is accession number 12224, and this is reel number 4.
Yes, so after Barham, was it?
Barham, yes.
You went to Husum, is that right?
Yes. I went, there was a new relief section formed, had just come out, and Eric Turner was, he became a member of that section. He too went from another section, and we both joined the section. We were hoping to be married at some time, and we were both working together then in section 133. And the leader was Harold Thrift and his wife Beatrice Thrift. Mm-hmm. And we were in Husum for some weeks, and we were looking after the people leaving a displaced persons camp. We were not there very long, and after that we went to Bochum in the Ruhr. Bochum was a desert of ruins. There was hardly anything standing, and the devastation was quite appalling. And there were people living underground in a cellar that was left of their house. Or you'd see an odd piece of corrugated tin with smoke coming out where they were trying to cook something. And the air raid shelters, which were called bunkers, were full of people living in very primitive conditions.
You were saying earlier on, Pip, you know, that it seemed a breakdown of law and order, almost anarchy. Was order restored by this time, by the time you've got to Bochum?
Well, everybody had ration cards, and I suppose they usually got some rations, but they got very little. And it was the summer. They were chopping down trees. I think they probably had chopped down trees long ago, but they were got to the point where they were uprooting the stumps for fuel, for burning. And they were certainly short of food. My job seemed, when I first went to Bochum, I think I seemed to be asked to do reports on the medical services in Bochum, and I looked at the refugees and what they were doing about infectious diseases and the hospitals and ambulance services and supplies of drugs. For instance, they were very short of insulin. They'd only got about 15 or 20% of their needs. And the infant mortality rate in Bochum was 23%. And for children for mothers, if they weren't able to breastfeed, I imagine the children probably just died because there wasn't milk. And these are the sort of things that we gave our attention to. I visited all the hospitals to have a look at what they were doing and the drugs they got and the bed linen they got. And we got in crates of cod liver oil. I think we had them from the Icelandic Red Cross. I remember those because they were in absolutely enormous barrels, the size of barrels that you get oil in from tankers. And we had the job of sort of trying to separate this and having vessels big enough to take large quantities so that we could distribute it amongst the infant welfare clinics. We also gave them bandages and swabs and that sort of thing. They were pretty well short of everything in their hospitals. And the buildings were often falling apart by ruins. I mean, the wards sort of wouldn't be waterproof, and they'd been bombed. I've got a lot of reports of the work that I did on the medical side in Bochum. And at one point I was asked to by Dr. Audrey Ellis to write a confidential report about the children. And I did a survey of infant mortality, and we had all the children that they're an English equivalent of health visitors. They called them all into all the clinics, and we looked at all the children. There was a great deal of rickets. We then started giving, I think we gave some ultraviolet treatment and cod liver oil. But with such a high infant mortality rate, there was quite a lot of edema in stomachs and signs of malnutrition in children. You know, children that should be sitting up that were, couldn't, and a lot of swollen stomachs, these children we picked out. We did a survey of all of them, and then the health visitors picked out the ones who were suffering from malnutrition, and these are the ones that we concentrated on. We also started feeding schemes, I think, for all the children under school age. The school age children were fed one meal at school, and so we concentrated on the preschool age children. And I think there was a Girl Guides team in Bochum, and they had supplies, and they were in this feeding scheme as well. But I went round to, I think, pretty well all the schools, all the clinics, organising feeding schemes. And where we couldn't, I mean, we did a lot of, I think, as far as I remember, we did cocoa and milk drinks, things to put as much nourishment into one drink as we could as well. I could say that. We had some difficulty. We tried first to work through the welfare organisations. That was the Catholic one, Caritas Verband, Inner Mission, which was the Evangelical Church, and Arbeiter Wohlfahrt, which was the socialist one. And they had they always wanted to get as much supplies for their own organisation as possible, and we always found it difficult. They were always slightly suspicious of each other. Dealing with them, we had to be very careful to be fair to everybody, and they would always try to get more. They'd sort of said, "Well, if you're going to do it in a school, well then you can feed all the school children," and we would protest that the Schul Amt was supposed to be doing that, and that was not what our supplies were supposed to be going for. And I think we did have some difficulty. I've got a report here of a youth club that I visited in the Ruhr. It was in Dahlhausen, and this is sort of quite interesting because of the effect that the war had on Nazi children. I visited this youth camp. It's the first one that I'd seen since being at the Radcliffe Centre. And the group met in a large house in Bochum. Most of it was badly damaged because it was a pretty badly damaged industrial town. But you wouldn't have thought so from the house. It was perched high up in a wood, and it was the pride and joy of the local Naturfreunde. They built this house as a hostel. And, of course, it was taken over by the Hitler Youth in 1933. So at the end of the war, they had it back. And the Nazis had deliberately smashed up everything and all the windows and all the crockery and the cinematograph and everything that they had and all the furniture. But they were very glad to have the building. As soon as we went into the room, we knew we'd enjoy ourselves. There were about 60 fresh-faced young boys and girls, and they were all singing at the tops of their voices. And it could have been any English youth group. Although they weren't quite as rowdy as the girls in Shadwell. And there was a slightly boisterous atmosphere of young people letting off steam, which was a bit like Shadwell. Eric was there too, and he said a few words in his rather halting German. And then they started asking him questions about English youth clubs, about Boy Scouts and youth hostels, and why it was that they were forbidden to talk politics, and what English youth thought about them. And that was rather a poser. One earnest boy asked how a conscientious objector was treated in England and how you could become one in Germany. It was not until the club had finished that a group gathered round us to ask the inevitable questions about rations. And we tried to relate their shortages to the world conditions, telling them of all the foodstuffs which were now imported into Germany and had been imported into Germany from the rest of the world when they themselves were starving. Considering that they were hungry nearly all the time, it was difficult to arouse their interest in the rest of the world, and it was surprising to us that they wanted to know about this and about youth organisations in England. We told them about the clubs and about the differences, and we were delighted to find that they were inquiring and receptive after 13 years of National Socialist education. All the youth clubs in the British zone now started are non-political. Even these Falcon clubs are run by the Social Democratic Party, but they're debarred from discussing any political questions. Although obviously they're burning to begin to talk politics. So much of our work in the Ruhr was grim and a bit depressing, but we really enjoyed this evening with these young people. And we hope that they'd soon be able to build up their own democracy. Because this is what we were supposed to be doing in Bochum. I've got all these reports about Don Suisse and where the supplies came from, and I've got masses of it. I think I must have written weekly, or I visited a prison. Which was a fairly grim experience.
That would have been with German sort of civilian
prisons. Yeah, a civilian prison. Yes. I also remember visiting this is quite interesting. I've got things I did on factory hygiene, and I was very concerned for the young apprentices, because the children who stayed at school to until they were 18 had additional meal. You know, they had a school meal every day. But the young apprentices, 14 to 18, who weren't in school, didn't get it. And I did a good amount of agitation about this, because they were working hard and I thought they should. Should we say that?
Yes. So did you get anywhere with that then, Pip? You know, did you manage to get the food?
I can't remember whether I did. It was referred to military government. When we first went to Germany, we were under BLA, which is British Liberation Army, and very soon afterwards it became British Army of the Rhine, and later it became military government, I think. I think that important questions like that would have been referred to military government. And I've got notes here about referring them back to Colonel so-and-so for some sort of action. It was very unfair that the apprentices, because they were working really hard. They were apprenticed for 3 years, and they were working really hard. And they didn't get any additional rations. And I remember the very sad story of somebody in one of the factories telling me that the boy had come home late last night and seen his butterbrot, his sandwich, ready for him on the table to take to work tomorrow, and he was hungry, so he ate it. So the next day he had to work and go the whole day without anything to eat. Whenever you went anywhere in Germany, if you were going round in the evening, you had to take your own bread and anything to eat with you, because they could never give you anything. We usually always used to try to take something with us that they wouldn't have.
Did you go to many German homes?
Yes, we did. Particularly the Evangelische Kirche. We were very friendly with the minister in one of the nearby churches. rather than the official people in Bochum. I remember being greeted by, we were greeted by the representative from the Inner Mission, who now I've forgotten his name, and it was I probably December 1945, and he greeted us with, well, we want some Quaker Speisung, and why have you been so long coming? And they were obviously, you know, thought it was theirs of right. But that was the only person I think we met like that. The pastor in the next village to where we were billeted was a very kind man, and he talked about how concerned he'd been for the Dutch and what the Germans were doing in Holland. He had done some of his theological training in Holland and was very fond of the people. And several of the people we met who were more thoughtful had been horrified by what was happening in Germany and did express their regret. And when we went back, we had a week's holiday, and we went back into Utrecht and spent it there. And he asked us to ask for their forgiveness. He was a very kind man. And there were a lot of people like this, and we did go into German homes, yes. A lot of teachers, but mostly the people we were working with. And we had a very nice little interpreter with whom I've stayed with her since we've been home, and she's been over here two or three times. We've been on very good terms.
Did you go as a married couple on these visits? You know, I was wondering whether it
No, we didn't. I didn't work. Very occasionally, when we went to visit, we probably did. But the rest of the time, I didn't, no.
Because I was wondering what difference it made to you being married. You know, first of all, did the FAU mind people getting married within the unit?
Well, they didn't seem to. I mean, we were married from Husum, and we went down to Vlota, which was the headquarters. And it was near
Piedmont, was it?
No. We spent our honeymoon at Bad Piedmont. Mm. No, I don't think they did. We were married in the Friends Meeting House at Bad Piedmont, and that was a wonderful occasion for German Quakers as well as for us, because they all came together. As far as I can tell, there can't be that many friends in Germany. I think there were 50 friends in East Germany. I don't know how many there are in West Germany, but not that many. And I think everybody who could travel to Bad Piedmont came to Bad Piedmont for our wedding. It was a wonderful celebration for German friends as well as our wedding. And it did make it a lovely occasion. We were married, first of all, I think in Vlota, by a Lieutenant Colonel Williams, who said, I am marrying you under the, I think it was the 1885 Foreign Marriages Act. Colonel so-and-so Williams is appointed to marry under this act, and then he said, that's me. And he married us in a very short ceremony, and then we went and had a Quaker wedding in the Friends Meeting House at Bad Piedmont. And most of this was arranged for us by Brenda's parents. Brenda was a friend of ours in the FAU, and still is. She is now Brenda Bailey, and we have been to her wedding in Friends House in London. And her parents came from Bad Piedmont. Her mother was English and her father was German, and he had been in Buchenwald, and he was at home. And Leonard and Mary Friedrich arranged our wedding for us, and we there were a lot of UNIC people there. There was also a visiting team from both FRS and FAU headquarters in London in Bad Piedmont. Characters, well-known people in the Society of Friends like Roger Wilson and Paul Cadbury, were also present at our wedding, and Tegla Davis. It was a fairly high-powered delegation who just happened to be there as well. So we've got some very good signatures on our certificate of marriage, which is the custom of Friends. We spent a honeymoon in Bad Pyrmont. It was a nice wooded hilly town. It's a health resort. It is now entirely a health resort, but during the war it was a centre for soldiers who had lost a limb, so that almost everybody walking around the town seemed to be on crutches, having lost a leg. We went back to Bad Pyrmont last year and had a very nice holiday there. It was an entirely materialistic health resort, in the sort that we simply don't have in this country, just full of sort of marble palaces that were health clinics. But the pine woods and country is very attractive around Bad Pyrmont, and it is the centre of the Society of Friends in Germany. I think I visited all the hospitals in Bochum, all the clinics and dispensaries, and tried to get a good idea of the whole of the health services. And I wrote a lot of reports about this. So these reports will be available.
Thank you very much, Pip. I know you're going to let the museum copy these, aren't you?
Yes.
Thank you. That's really very kind of you. I suppose really your relief work that you did in Holland and Germany, it gave you a very good idea of what war is all about, I would think, did it not? The devastation.
I think it really confirmed my pacifism at the time. War is a dreadful thing, and so many millions of men were killed, and so much misery. It took years for Europe to recover, and we would go past sometimes a camp of Hungarian boys. They were very wild and uncontrollable by anybody. I imagine they're very much like the street children of Buenos Aires. I don't know what happened to those children. And there were many groups of children wandering about by themselves. They probably just wanted to get away. They may have wanted to go home, but for a lot of them, they can't have known where home was. And we had a lot of inquiries about missing people. And the Red Cross, of course, has got a very substantial bureau. We used to try and look for people. We looked for several people, one or two Quakers, and other people. I think all the records are probably destroyed in most of the towns, and this made it very difficult to check up on anyone. And as the buildings weren't there either, it was difficult. Cologne was another place. It was quite near Bochum, in near the Ruhr, and that was a heap of ruins. And marvellously, the cathedral was mostly standing. It was closed, I think, because it was damaged, but it was standing. And the Germans had a black market in front of that cathedral, quite a substantial black market. I think I've got a photograph of it, but unless I told you what the groups of people were doing, you wouldn't know.
But, you know, I wondered if you thought, you know, given what happened under Hitler, how he could have been coped with. Did you have any opinions for that? You know, how does the world cope with someone like Hitler? And today, I suppose, Saddam Hussein, you know, which people are likening.
I think during the 30s, I had always thought that the Treaty of Versailles was very unfair. I think it it was responsible for the rise of Hitler. And I think probably the way that Hussein has been treated is the same. I think we've bolstered him to quite an extent and then suddenly turn on him. And because when he goes too far, we didn't worry about the Kurds. I think that I would be rather more doubtful about saying that we shouldn't have some sort of police force come army now, which I might not have accepted during the war. But I would like to see the United Nations much strengthened and able to cope with situations where there's violence. I think in almost any dispute, it is so in Ireland, it is so almost anywhere, where there are national disputes, it has come about from vindictive treatment of past generations. And I think nowhere is this more obvious than in Ireland. But the only way that there's going to be any solution is by some form of mediation, reconciliation, isn't it? I was throughout the that dreadfully cold winter we had, Wolverhampton friends were demonstrating against war in the Gulf before it started, and after it started, we did it twice as well. I think it was a war that need not have happened. I think it's almost always a breakdown of diplomacy, and the way politicians get praise for winning war seems to me to be quite disgraceful. They should all be sacked for having brought us to that situation, because we shouldn't get there, should we? I think that friends are can be quite good as mediators, and I hope that we shall do more of this, because I think, mind you, there are quite a few people in the army as well who are quite good at mediating, because we have met some of them, and they have, with the experience of war behind them, I think have learnt a lot, and we ought to use people who have these skills to prevent the conflicts from boiling over. I think it was very obvious in the Gulf War why on earth we had to attack. I don't know. Sanctions would have worked and less injury would have been done to people, to country, and their property if we had continued with sanctions. I know that some friends think that sanctions are a violence, and I agree that to some extent they are. But as somebody who hasn't bought South African fruit for about 30 years, I feel that sanctions do work. In the Gulf, I think they would have worked, because they were very... I think that they could have been very badly affected by full sanctions. I think that Jordan would have suffered. But then perhaps... I think that Jordan has, in fact, behaved very well during this crisis. I think they have done their level best to have prevented the war, to stop it spreading. I think that Jordan has behaved very commendably. I think they tried to mediate, to reconcile the different countries and interests. I think they did all they could to stop this war. And I think at great cost to themselves, they've dealt with nearly a million refugees, and most of whom are dispersed and home now, although I think there are still a few in Jordan. And Jordan is a poor country, and I think they have probably suffered from this war very greatly.